Jenna, it's June of 2021. Why are we talking about this episode from 2018?
I'm just going to invoke Gia from Real Housewives of New Jersey circa 2011, that I've been waking up in the morning thinking about so many things. That's a really specific TikTok reference, but those who know, know. You know, this episode has haunted me for the last 3 years.
Oh my God, really?
Yeah. And, you know, that sounds stressful, but I also think it's one of the perks of our job, you know, in some ways, which is that the things we make and the things we write really stick with people. And they bring up the things they loved. And they also bring up the things they didn't love, you know?
Oh, they do. They do.
And I spent a lot of time thinking about some of the things we talked about in this episode. And one of the reasons we wanted to make this episode way back in May of 2018 is because we were noticing a ton of famous people, musicians, actors, all kinds of celebrities who were making these public declarations about their sexual orientation. And we were trying to figure out some common thread. We were trying to make sense of it. And I think we were also really interested in public consumption of self and how that is mediated through that filter.
So, Jenna, what are people asking you when this episode comes up? Like, what is the thing that people are articulating as a problem?
The feedback that I've gotten has just been a lot of hurt feelings and anger.
Really?
Which I get. Yeah. Okay. I think it feels really hard to feel someone who is in queer community, who is in POC community, be dismissive of someone else's expression of self. Mm-hmm. And I get that, you know, it doesn't feel good to listen to someone try to regulate or even police how someone else is working out their identity in the public eye. I mean, Wesley, you and I are in the public eye, right? But we're not in the public eye the way a top tier international singer is. You know what I mean?
Janelle Monáe is a different level right. of fame than,
right.
than whatever this is.
So to be critical of how someone like that is tiptoeing their way into a public expression of queerness feels really hard. And I get that. I really get that.
So what do you want to do? How do you want to solve this? What do you want to say?
Well, I want to say a couple of things. I mean, first, I want to acknowledge that that was not me at my best self. And I do want to apologize for being dismissive and picking apart something that I didn't quite understand. And I feel terrible about it. It really has kept me up more nights than I'd like to admit. And yeah, that's not who I want to be as a person or who I want to be on this show. So I am really sorry for doing that in this very public way. And it's wild to me because there is an enormous tell embedded in the use of humor to mask something that makes me uncomfortable, right? That's the biggest indication, especially when it comes to gay and queer things, that whenever someone is minimizing something or maybe punching down at it, there's usually a reason for it. There's something embedded in them that's being activated, as it was for me. And it was something that I wasn't even acknowledging for myself.
God is trying to tell you something. God
yeah.
is trying to tell you something.
And in the 3 years since that episode has come out, you know, I've become more embodied. I've become more in touch with self. Like my own identity has evolved. You know, I have recognized that I'm non-binary. I do identify also as pansexual. And so it's also so strange to think about
why
I was feeling so dismissive. You know, there was something in me that I was pushing back against because it was familiar or maybe really scary. So I guess the thing I feel really grateful for is humility, mm-hmm. you know, enough of a dehydrated ego to be able to sit with the things that are really uncomfortable. It's hard to be someone who makes mistakes in public, but I also feel like it's the most human thing too.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that feels so indicative of how much has changed in the last handful of years. I mean, we made that show a mere 3 years ago, but it might as well be 30 years ago in terms of how much the culture has changed since then.
Yes.
It's bananas.
Yep.
Thanks to everyone who listened, who sent feedback, and who pushed me to think harder about the things I said.
So with that, here's our episode about sexuality. So it's Wednesday night. I'm probably a sophomore in college. We had a TV in my room, in my dorm, and I used to watch Ellen. It wasn't called Ellen at the time. My first season was called something else because Friends came eventually and made the show change its name. It was one of these sitcoms about people who basically sit around and talk about their friendships and the dates they go on. And one of the people that went on these dates, of course, is Ellen DeGeneres. There's this one episode where she goes on this date. And I wouldn't have known it at the time, but it's with the person we now know to be Peter Krause, 6 feet under Peter Krause.
Oh.
And they go on this date. And, you know, whenever Ellen would go on a date on this show, something always just seemed off.
You don't say.
She's wearing this blazer that doesn't fit her and these brown pants. And it just, all of the signals are pointing to something that I could not articulate, but just seeing her sit across from this man, who conveniently enough, by the way, is basically dressed like her. So the energy is just so palpably awkward.
Now, so is it me or is this going really well?
This,
us, our date.
Well, we have made very few mistakes. The mistake column remains empty.
You know, maybe we should start planning a second night out.
Oh, I don't know. It's a little early for that.
Oh.
Okay, I'm ready. Where do you want to go?
And Ellen actually has to take a sip of wine. Let this just like, just think about this.
Yeah.
Ellen takes this sip of wine.
She's like, let me numb myself.
And the date is increasingly contingent on her drinking wine to say yes.
And is that part of the punchline or the joke or?
Well, this is the crazy thing about this episode.
I remember Club Joshua. You know, the only time I went there, I got carded.
Oh, don't you love when that happens? It's so flattering.
Oh, no, I couldn't get in. Actually, it was the night of my high school graduation.
Wait, when was this?
87.
Oh, okay, so I get it. So you must have been kept back. 7 or 8 grades.
The name of the episode is The Hand That Robs the Cradle.
Huh.
And the comedy is supposed to be Ellen dates a younger man.
Oh, interesting.
But that's
not the real joke.
And in the episode, at some point, she wants to go out and find an outfit that signifies young, hip, cool. And she winds up at some, you know, hip LA boutique. And the saleswoman is like, I'm going to find you something. She gets something, hands it to Ellen. She goes, this, I think, is you.
And what is it?
And the curtain sort of swooshes down upon Ellen and hides her away. She puts on this jacket, comes out
of a closet.
In a gay flag blazer.
No, she does not.
Oh, yes, she does.
Oh, my God. Also, who made this blazer and can I get it? It's almost June. Wait, what?
Yes. This is the first season of this show.
Interesting.
She's going to spend 4 more years, like, winking at this thing that she won't put into language and the show won't acknowledge because she'll still go on dates with men and she'll still wonder, like, why they're not going so well.
And why did it bother you so much? I want you to pinpoint the feeling because you're in college. You're, like, what, 17, 18, 19, super juicy, like, coming into yourself. And why did it frustrate you to watch someone who you suspected was a Mo not be honest about themselves on TV?
Because I was lying too!
I'm Jenna Wortham.
And I'm Wesley Morris. We're two culture writers at the New York Times.
And this is Still Processing.
I wanted somebody to just say, look, this is the deal. I am this thing. And instead of playing games, I'm going to be this thing.
You were looking for an instruction manual.
But instead, I got a mirror.
You got to choose your own adventure with no page numbers at the bottom. You're like, what do I turn to? What page is next?
Ellen was literally coming out of this curtain closet in a rainbow flag blazer like 4 years before making the nation pay attention to her actually coming out of a closet, a figurative closet.
Well, Wesley, what we want to talk about today is this particular moment in gayness that we seem to be experiencing and why it reminds you of Ellen in the 90s and is re-triggering for you in some way. Reed Ora puts a song out called Girls. It doesn't land exactly how they intended. People are offended because it feels like it's a song about girl-on-girl action that you would play in a peep show, not necessarily a song that girls who are into girls would play because they feel empowered by it.
Yes, strip club sexuality is what I'm calling it.
Which there's nothing wrong with, which we can talk about. But it feels performative, and it feels very much for a male audience. I'm the hunter, and she the prey. I'm the thriller, and the killer, and the savior of all night. It's a song version of the Cruel Intentions kiss between Sarah Michelle Gellar and Selma Blair. It's purely for the audience, not really about anyone's actual identity. Or that's the idea. So the song creates this big uproar. Reed Ora has to come out and explain her sexuality, which she does in a very kind of roundabout way. A lot of singers who do openly identify as lesbian and gay, including Hayley Kiyoko, come out and say this is harmful. But then Cara Delevingne, a model and actress, who's come out as being not heterosexual, defends the song. So it's creating this really interesting debate about what it means to be, quote unquote, out in public in 2018.
Yeah.
Then you have all these other things happening at the same time, the same cultural moment. Donald Glover in the upcoming Star Wars movie says Lando's character is pansexual, which makes sense if you think about space, all the sexual space beings, you want to mess with them, sure. And then the singer Kalani, who's 23, she and Demi Lovato are both having this moment in pop culture where they're kissing on stage, they're both talking about their sexual identities, they both say they don't identify as straight, and they're both kind of having these really interesting publicly facing conversations about how they identify. And all of these things are landing on different parts of the acceptability spectrum in terms of the social media court of justice. Reed Ora, seen as bad. Kalani's seen as endearing and cute. Donald Glover, we still don't know what to do with him. And of course, I guess in the center of all this is the singer Janelle Monáe, who puts out an album called Dirty Computer about her love of women. Pink like the inside of your baby. Pink like the walls and the doors. Deep inside. Maybe pink like your fingers in my. Maybe pink is the truth you can't hide. And then also says, yeah, I don't identify as straight. I've had relationships with men and with women. And everyone is celebrating. But you and I are kind of excited, but also confused because so much of this feels declarative without really saying very much at all. Pink is my
favorite part. I'm really struck by this identification without identity, right? You're picking something off the buffet, by the way, off the LBGDQIA buffet. And it's just so different from how things were when Ellen had a sitcom.
Of course.
I'm just really trying to think about, is this political? Is the whole goal of this political movement that gay people have been a part of for decades really just about being able to like make Lando Calrissian pansexual in outer space?
It will be interesting to talk about whether or not these expressions of identity feel like blueprints for other people. Because one thing that really struck me is in the few moments ago you were saying what frustrated you about Ellen's ambiguity is that you needed a fine point to understand your own edges and your own contours of self. So maybe a way to think about this also is, you know, kids are different these days. Like more kids don't feel like they have to identify or belong. I think we have to look at how the language around how we are allowed to identify has shifted. But I also think we have to look at whether or not these expressions of identity square up with actions, right? Like, it's fine if you're saying, I'm not worried about the gender. I'm not worried about orientation. I just love who I love.
Like, that's a pretty vague thing to say. And does that move a needle during a time when we are living under administration that is actively trying to roll back gay rights? This isn't that dissimilar from the conversation we've been having about what it means to be biracial and what it means to pass and mm-hmm. what it means to mm-hmm. use an identity or align yourself with an identity when it's convenient for you and be able to step away from it when it's not.
Right. Yes.
And I think that's part of what's triggering you right now, which is this feeling that you can maybe benefit from being more aligned with queerness, which is definitely more acceptable, more marketable, and much more visible, but also not really saying whether or not you're into women.
Yes. If you have to sort of announce something about yourself and that announcement has something to do with what your sexuality is and you feel it gnawing at you, that is, even in 2018, not a necessarily easy thing to have to disclose.
Right, right.
And right. it's interesting to have that still be like a fact of just human social nature at the same time that you have this really interesting trip to the past, to the 90s, where things like Will and Grace have come back.
Uh-huh.
Pose is about to start right. on FX. And you've got Queer Eye for the Straight Guy, which is not from the 90s, but barely not.
It feels like a relic, though. It feels like something that was very declarative about gayness in the past that's resurfaced in the present moment.
So you have the present going and kind of like unlocking the closet doors of the past in this really interesting way. I like the idea of having these labels sort of be demolished in a lot of ways and collapsed.
Expanded.
Right.
And
yeah. You said something earlier that I've been thinking about since you said it. You just wanted to make it clear what you weren't saying when people were annoyed at Rita Ora's song.
Mm-hmm.
The scandal wasn't that Rita Ora was declaring herself interested in women at all. It
right.
was the opposite,
right.
where they wanted a cleaner declaration and they wanted it not attached to this. To the rest of the song.
Right. To like and, nipple tassels
yes.
and like a hip shake and like the idea that you have to be drunk. That's like that old joke, like what's the difference between a gay man and a straight man? Have you heard this?
Alcohol.
A six pack.
Yeah.
In both ways. Like a six pack of beer. And then. But you know, but that's the frustrating thing though. It's like there is something about queerness and gayness that we're actively trying to shed, which is the shame around it.
Mm-hmm.
That it's something you only do in the dark. It's
yes.
something that you only can do inebriated and that you have to kind of make a joke out of it. Or that it's something that is in the shadows. And that song, weirdly, to some people, felt that way.
And, you know, it's a song that is mostly written by men. And it just feels like it has nothing to do with the desire that women have for each other.
Right.
It doesn't feel real to bisexuals.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so I think that the urge for authentic selfhood is still true in 2018, and it's as true in 2018 as it was, you know, in 1995 or 4.
So it's funny because what we're kind of talking about is authenticity, and we're also talking about whether there are still smoke signals of mm-hmm. shame around mm-hmm. these declarations.
Yeah.
It's not
yeah.
actually the ambiguity. It's
yes.
more of like, how much are you actually embracing this identity versus still playing with it?
Right.
Because I don't know, the idea
it's
that you can
game.
Play, it's not a game.
Right.
I was thinking about this a lot. I really liked what Hayley Kiyoko said in response to the Rita Ora song, which was, she tweeted, how did notes also become the new long-form way to tweet a statement anyway? So she wrote something in her notes app and then tweeted it out. And I really liked this part that said, don't capitalize on other people's identities. It is that deep. We are mad. We are tired. We've effing had it with this SHIT XOXO, basically gay women. I was going through her catalog of songs, and she has a song called Curious. If you let them touch you, touch you, touch you, touch you, touch you, touch you. Mm-hmm. That if this were 10 years ago would be about being curious about whether or not she likes women. However, the song is actually about her curiosity about whether or not her ex is serious about the guy she's with, or does she miss her? And it's just such a really fun, sexy pop song.
Mm-hmm. It's not loaded or fraught or
yeah.
tragic or, yes.
It's kind of even making fun of this woman who
yes.
is kind of on the fence.
Yes.
I feel like that is where we are, not girls or this sort of flirtation with sexuality. We're very much swimming in it. No, don't you worry, I can handle it. You know, it's so interesting though to have this conversation because I feel I'm both really, really, really encouraged by the lessening of the rigidity of a not heterosexual identity.
Mm-hmm.
Because it took me a while to figure out kind of where I was on the spectrum. And I always felt really, really pressured to choose and mm-hmm. to make a statement about, well, what are you and what's your deal? And the only way I could enter into gay spaces in the 2000s is if I was able to look apart, you know, really clearly, like, give like a gay resume mm-hmm. of how many women I dated or how many men I dated. And only then could I really qualify as someone who could be in this space. I mean, that's kind of how it felt to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I never really, I mean, I'm also biracial, so I'm not comfortable feeling like I have to fit into a space or I have to look a certain way or talk a certain way, dress a certain way in order to be gained acceptance into a club. So I actually really love, you know, I keep thinking about Kalani because I just think she's so talented and so sweet. And I love the way she was just openly like, here's who I'm attracted to. I love Twinkie men. Like, I love, like, she just was like, this is what I like. I really love women. I really love trans people. Like, I really love this. And of course, then she kind of had to backpedal because she was like, I don't mean to objectify. I don't mean to. But she was really just talking about expressing something that's like actually historically very dangerously just to like openly be like, mm-hmm. yo, mm-hmm. I'm open. So I find it to be really liberating. And I can imagine for young people who are in a similar position, who aren't really ready to change their avatar on Facebook to a rainbow flag, also really liberating that there are other people who don't have to be so specific and choose. And at the same time, I feel like it would be really useful to have, you know, a show like She's Gotta Have It actually map out what it looks like for women to be in relationship to other women. Because how else do you know?
Mm-hmm.
If you don't have a gay Sherpa, which I didn't have. I mean, I did get it, but like late in life. I mean, did you have someone who literally told you how to do what you needed to do?
I did. I'm thinking about who this person was, and he was an administrator at my school. And there was no language. He didn't really ask me any questions. Mm-hmm. He just ID'd me as probably gay.
Wow.
He was kind of like the Professor X of gay people at my school. He's like, I detect a mutant here. I detect a mutant here. I detect a mutant here. I'm going to gather them together and make sure they're safe and bring them
really
to my
sweet.
Academy. And he never asked me if I was gay. I knew he was, but he never said anything. And I'd go over to his house and, you know, nothing creepy or weird ever happened. It was like he loved making sure that kids were going to be okay because it was hard.
Yeah.
You know, I went to boarding school with mostly Black men and women, and we just get over this stuff. And it was one of those things where everybody wanted to make sure everybody else was okay at some point. Mm. And so the harm that might have come to me in a different environment never came to me there. But he was a huge part of just like, he showed me New York. You know,
that's
he
cool.
made sure that I got to spend time around these other like older kids who were gay.
That was the analog version of It Gets Better.
Yeah, it really was. I mean, he wanted to make sure I didn't suffer.
But see, maybe his job would have been different if Janelle Monáe was out when you were a kid that this person could point to and say, you know what? A lot of people are like this.
I do think that for people who were 17 or 18 years old, seeing Janelle Monáe and say that Pink video with all of that sort of vaginal iconography that she is moving around in, if you don't know that Janelle Monáe has announced herself as a queer person, I mean, I don't know if
she didn't use that language, but people are ascribing it to her. But
well, what is the language that she actually used?
She said she's been in a relationship with men and women, and she feels more pansexual, which is also the term that Angel Hayes used in 2013 when she came out to BuzzFeed. Miley Cyrus has said she feels pansexual. Pansexual is sort of the go-to term for people in the public eye who want to declare themselves as something other than straight, which is really fascinating to me because it feels a little like there's an escape hatch, an ejector seat that they can still, you know, zoom out of.
But it's kind of like coming out versus giving yourself an out, which something I just stole that from you.
That's good. That's really good.
That's a Jenna Wortham special that I just wrote down and just gave back to you. And it is true. Like, I mean, the whole problem with these stupid labels is that they're not stupid.
But there is a distinction between someone like Janelle Monáe saying, I've been in relationships with men and I've been in relationships with women, versus Kristen Stewart coming out on Saturday Night Live and just going, I'm so gay. Like, literally so gay.
Yeah.
Like, that to me was a huge moment.
Also, it was a huge moment that went nowhere, right? It wasn't like she spent the next 2 months having to explain herself.
Right. And she'd also been in a relationship with a man,
right,
very visibly, yes, very publicly, several men.
Yes.
So she didn't even need to say, like, I'm actually pansexual. She was just like, I'm gay.
Yes.
I'm figuring it out, but I'm basically gay. And I think that, I don't know, that to me feels super exhilarating.
Does it feel exhilarating, though, because it's familiar?
It just felt really bold.
Yes.
And it, yeah, still felt, mm-hmm, like there's room for her to be
do
in a relationship with
wants
men again.
Yeah.
I don't know. She gave an interview that said why she decided to come out in that way that she did. And she said, I hated that details of my life were being turned into a commodity and peddled around the world. But considering that I had so many eyes on me, I suddenly realized that my private life affects a greater number of people than me. It was an opportunity to surrender a bit of what was mine to make even one other person feel good about themselves.
Oh, wow. That's...
it's huge. It made me
feel
good.
Actually, it's really moving.
Yeah.
Well, let's take a break, and we're going to talk when we come back about why having someone like Kristen Stewart say that would have meant the world to me in 1991.
We saw your photos in a magazine.
Mm. Yeah, it was the pictures of the twins that you showed us.
But they called you Ronnie Curtis.
That's my professional name.
What was wrong with your real name? Krushka, you should be proud of it.
Artists change their names sometimes, don't they, Moshe?
That's right, Fru.
Yeah.
Well.
Women change their names every day. They take their husband's names and their own history is gone. Don't they?
You and I both saw this movie called Disobedience.
We sure did.
I really like this movie a lot. We're talking about two women in England in the present day.
Mm-hmm.
One, it played by Rachel Weisz, who lives in New York City, goes back for the death of her father, who's a like very prominent rabbi in this Orthodox community. And she seems to have left her Judaism behind when she abruptly left,
mm-hmm,
X number of years ago. And she returns to her two good friends who are now, to her surprise, married. They're played by Rachel McAdams,
mm-hmm,
who's really, really wonderful in this movie.
Every one of the film is so good,
yeah,
I think.
And Alessandro Nivola, who she's married to. And the three of them are reliving this moment that they had as friends and the trauma of her having left and what her return has awakened or will awaken in the Rachel McAdams character, who is living a very serious Orthodox life and has suppressed whatever went on between these two women years ago. And the movie, you know, it's your classic coming out or self-acceptance drama, except it's set in a community in which this is beyond forbidden.
And yet still openly very discussed.
Yes!
Which is fascinating.
Yeah, yeah.
I thought the movie was great. I loved it. It's my Call Me By Your Name for sure. Although, I don't understand why these movies can never really figure out how women have sex. Blue is the Warmest Color couldn't do it. Disobedience couldn't do it. She's Gotta Have It couldn't do it. I'm always just like, why is this so hard to figure out?
Yeah.
I don't understand. Like, just ask someone.
Well, none of the things you named, by the way, are made by women.
That's also part of the problem, too. For any director or cinematographer who needs a more accurate picture of what it actually looks like when women have sex with each other, my advice would be go on XTube or RTube, just search for amateur girl couples and have a ball, because there's lots to draw from on there. I will say, though, there are a lot of movies that and shows that are getting it right. I'd say The Miseducation of Cameron Post, which came out, the Park Chan-wook movie, Handmaiden. The character Nova on Queen's Sugar is bisexual or not hetero. Her sex scenes are great with women. Also, my favorite, like, teen gay movie, But I'm a Cheerleader, Clea DuVall, Natasha Lyonne, so sensual. The gay couple on the TV show Easy that's on Netflix, those are actually all really good examples of, I don't need to go into detail. If you're curious, check those examples out.
Mm-hmm.
In the midst of all these, you know, ambiguous coming out moments, it actually does feel revelatory that a major motion picture comes out with two mainstream big name actresses who are not gay playing, you know, gay or gay adjacent women and working through what it means to be in a sexual relationship with each other. And there's nothing about this movie that feels performative to me or it feels opportunistic or the way like Blue is the Warmest Color, that French film that came out a few years ago, felt like it was kind of capitalizing on the, you know, excitement and eroticism and scandal of like showing these bodies of these two women. It was, I mean, I love that movie, but it also felt a little bit, you know, parasitic in a way that Disobedience does not. So if we're confused about whether or not this moment is a big deal, it's a huge deal because of a movie like Disobedience that feels like it's trying to angle itself for something like an Oscar by making a movie about these two women in this Orthodox community who are in love.
Mm-hmm.
The other really important thing about Disobedience, most movies about women falling in love with other women historically involve death or tragedy, even My Beloved L Word, High Art, Blue is the Warmest Color, Heavenly Creatures, My Summer of Love, you know, all of these really, really, really iconic films. Like if you're a woman who is trying to figure out what it means to be in love with other women, they pretty much all end in tragedy. This movie doesn't, and that's huge. It's huge.
Mm-hmm. So this is why I really love the sex scene in Disobedience.
Okay, the sex scene in Disobedience is amazing! Even though it's not exactly accurate, it's still amazing.
So much of what was so powerful and sensual to me about that sequence was how much it meant to the Rachel McAdams character and how freeing this encounter is. And like what she's acting is just the shedding, like all of this history, all of this shame, all of this religious oppression, these things that she just sort of naturally went along with.
Yeah.
Because it's what you do in a culture.
Yeah.
But she's given this respite from all of that. And just the way she experiences Rachel Weisz's body and
like the absolute abandon and everything about her body. And
really,
and there's a really, I would say, it's a shocking moment just because it's so unexpected.
I have to ask you about this because I've never seen it before, but go on.
Should we just talk about what it was?
Yes.
So there's a moment where the two women are embracing and they're on the floor. And that's the thing. They're so passionate. They never even make it to the bed. They don't get to the bed until like the end of the scene, which is also like endearing and just really, really charming. But there's a scene when Rachel Weisz is laying on top of Rachel McAdams and she's spitting into her mouth. And Rachel McAdams' character is just like lapping it up with just like the most joy and happiness. And I have to say, like, I'm sure some people do that. It's not like part of what most people do, I'd
say. Yeah, I've never experienced that move.
But I think what it's supposed to really embody is like a complete lack of shame about what this woman's body is producing. And I actually really want to play a clip that's related to this from a film called After Sex that is one of the few films about like lesbians in college. It's Zoe Saldana, Mila Kunis. You've never seen this movie?
No.
I like it. Okay. I mean, what does it taste like? Look, does it taste like chicken? Does it taste like potatoes? I mean, does it taste like tuna?
Don't. Oh, I can't.
Well, no, you know, it smells like tuna.
No, it depends, okay? It depends. It's always a little different, and I guess it's a little salty. And everybody's unique.
What do I taste like?
I would just assume it's nasty, so.
Why?
It's a moist cavity between your legs, Kat.
A moist cavity?
It is, okay? And it sometimes gets sweaty. So it sometimes smells. It's just a little gross.
That really does kind of embody the way women are socialized to treat their own bodies and what makes it hard for women to publicly talk about having sex with other women, because there is this idea that a woman's body is just by default smelly or gross, mm-hmm. or that the fact it makes secretions or bleeds, and not all women's bodies bleed. I mean, some bodies that are not women identified bleed, just to say that, because it's true. But there's something inherently unsanitary about wanting to engage in more ways than we think are possible with secreting bodies. And that scene in Disobedience for me is really about, there's nothing gross that can come out of Rachel Weisz's body. And I think if they could have shown other liquids coming out of her orifices and her drinking them, they would. And I think that's actually what it was supposed to embody, that she could lap the spit out of her mouth and find it erotic.
Jenna, I kind of want to go back to this question of authenticity that we were talking about before. And you were talking before about like what the culture gets wrong about sex scenes, and I was thinking about the veneer of shame that frustrates authenticity. I mean, is what's wrong with the sex that you've been seeing in these movies, is that what stops you from believing in the identities of the people? Or does it automatically discount the movie?
No, of course not. It's just, you know, I think if we go back to the very beginning of the show and you talked about being interested in a blueprint and being interested in something that felt like you could map yourself onto it, mm-hmm. which is what we try mm-hmm. to do mm-hmm. when we look for visions of ourselves and versions of ourselves in popular culture. We look to be reflected so we can get a sense of how to construct a sense of self that's not entirely obviously artificial and based on something you see on a screen, but like we're trying to figure out how to be.
Right.
And how to articulate the experiences and things that we're going through. So when I think, you know, when I see something that's not that believable or feels off, it doesn't invalidate my experience, but it does make me question what my experience is if no one else seems to understand it.
So why did the sex in Blue is the Warmest Color feel inauthentic to you?
Let me break it down for you. Because I think in particular, Blue is the Warmest Color, the French film that came out in
2013.
By
Abdellatif Kechiche.
Starring
Léa Seydoux and Adèle Exarchopoulos.
I love playing movie Mad Libs with you. You're so good. So that movie was hailed as sort of this incredible film about lesbianism and women, and there were all these really extended sex scenes, and I think many viewers felt that it was very accurate portrayal of what those dynamics are like. And there are things about that movie that I really enjoy, especially the character Adèle, who comes into this gay community, and like just the emotion she's feeling and her sort of turmoil about not being attracted to her really beautiful boyfriend, but mm-hmm. then seeing this woman and like being confused and how her friends respond. Like all of those things really, really, really emotionally hit home. But when it comes down to their actual sexual interactions, the thing that's so weird in that movie is you're very much situated, yeah, on the edge of the mattress watching them engage versus something like, okay, so my iconic heterosex scenes on screen are Love and Basketball mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. and also Ryan Phillippe and Reese Witherspoon in Cruel Intentions. Because the cameras are just so close, the lighting is so soft, you feel like you're in their bodies versus wanting to be on top of their bodies. Mm-hmm. It just, you feel like the tenderness and the tentativeness of like two people exploring each other for the first time versus in Blue and the Warmest Color, it feels almost like just an extended, almost like porn scene of what someone thinks it looks like when two women are going down each other. It feels really devoid and stripped of sensuality.
But even the sex that you're talking about feels unprecedented to me. Mm. And even like, even the wrong, incorrect fantasy-oriented sex that you're talking about feels unprecedented in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. And it just didn't exist in mainstream non-pornographic culture the way that it does now. Mm. And it wasn't as easy to find as it obviously is now. And I was thinking about where I was in like the early 90s when I was a teenager. You know, in mainstream American culture, there were these signals, right? Mm. And without even realizing I had a radar, or, you know, what I eventually learned was a gaydar, I was looking for, not from people, but from the culture, that whatever I was feeling was okay.
Of course.
And I feel like you're talking about sex, and sex is something that happens between and among people. And I think the difference between what's happening now and what was happening in the 90s and the 80s and for decades and decades before that was a sense of loneliness, mm. right? And it wasn't, I mean, say what you will about Rita Ora. She doesn't seem lonely in this mess she sort of has had like displaced upon her.
If she's lonely, it has nothing to do with the song. It just has everything to do about her position as a celebrity. Yeah. There's a whole other conversation.
So in looking for something to grab onto in some ways, and I don't even know that I was necessarily looking for it. It kind of found me. But I was a big R.E.M. fan when I was a kid. I loved
so
R.E.M.
Cute.
But in 1991, Out of Time comes out. Mm-hmm. The first single from this record is Losing My Religion. Everybody knows it. Everybody's heard it 1,000 times. And I know that, like, people really focused on, like, Losing My Religion is a Southern colloquialism for getting mad.
Hmm.
And it's true. It is. But there's so much going on in that song. And, like, I felt like this song was saying something to me about the person singing it.
Mm.
Consider this, hint of the century. Consider this.
needed this deep read. Like, I didn't know Michael Stipe was working on all these different frequencies. Okay.
I heard the frequency.
Okay.
And
you tuned in.
It's so, it's unfair to compare that to Girls.
Oh.
But it's such a beautiful, like, you don't even need to declare anything because the song in itself is a declaration and I heard it.
Aww.
And I don't know that I needed this person to tell me he was gay because it clearly is a song about struggling with yourself. And as a 15 or 16 year old hearing this.
You could just put yourself into it. You could teleport into it.
Yes. And Michael Stipe, for whatever reason, magically was easy to harmonize with.
Of course, I loved
trying to sing along with him. I got very jealous when he and Mike Mills would sing songs together, who's the bassist in the band.
But you know what's so fascinating about what you're elucidating right now is when we're talking about authenticity, you're not necessarily talking about authenticity of your identity. It's about authenticity of the way it's influencing how you move and the materials you make and what you're producing.
Yes.
And the tone of your actions.
Yes. Yes. And if you think about what most pop songs are about.
Right, right.
They're about love and sex.
And desire. And the fun of it and the thrill of it. And when it feels fake.
Right.
It's fake.
And this is the realest.
That's the realest
deal. The realest deal. Aww. And the other thing that I just really want to go back to this loneliness, right?
Mm.
This is a lonely song. It's a lonely video. Mm. He's alone in this video.
Mm.
He's always alone in videos, by the way. He's never coupled with anybody, even the band, a lot of the time. And I'm remembering this song, and I'm thinking about Ellen DeGeneres, and I'm thinking about all of the obvious gayness that was in our midst in the 1980s and 90s. You know, you had an artist like Jermaine Stewart. Do you remember that guy?
No.
We don't have to take our clothes off.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, Jermaine Stewart was the gayest pop star you were ever going to see.
Uh-huh.
And there was no stigma against Jermaine Stewart.
Mm-hmm.
He bopped around TV for like 3 or 4 years.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, Annie Lennox, while not gay, definitely played with gay iconography and like awakened some, she made me pay attention to her in her real sort of embrace of a kind of masculinity that was also, I mean, she wasn't feminine, but she sounded like a woman. It was this really interesting time where everything that is happening now was happening then, but the political stakes were just totally different.
Mm.
And so it felt like a radical act to even, to do what Janelle Monáe is doing now was just, it doesn't feel radical. It feels like a, I don't want to say it feels like a shtick, but it definitely feels like a performance of something that had been already worked out in some way.
Right.
This doesn't feel to me like someone figuring something out in her art. This feels like, it feels processed to me.
Or not fully processed yet.
It's either completely overbaked
or completely underbaked.
Yes.
But that's also been true of her entire career as an artist, I think. And, you know, that there's always been a little bit of, and maybe this is what she's working through in this album, and maybe she's getting closer to it, but it's always been a little bit of a stilted expression of self that's hard to kind of really map yourself onto.
Yeah. And so you hear someone like Melissa Etheridge or Katie Lang, people who weren't out when they, like, they weren't openly gay when they started making this music. But you can hear the want, the need, the struggle, the torment in these songs.
Michelle Indicello as well.
Michelle Indicello. Well, Michelle Indicello is a tricky one, though, because, you know, her first single, her first big single was If That's Your Boyfriend, He Wasn't Last Night. You know, that was, she's tricky because she was so obviously queer. But at that point, I mean, she herself was gender fluid without us even really having a term for what she was. Madonna was the same way. I think her kissing Britney is a kind of Janelle Monáe moment.
That's right? A hot, hot, spicy take, sir. But I hear you.
I just feel like Madonna was a person who had already done the work. She'd already done all of the sort of revolutionary stuff with, you know, gayness, queerness, you know, in terms of how we're thinking about this pansexuality now, she was definitely, she would describe herself probably as pansexual.
I think I was thinking about Cardi B a lot too, just to bring it back to Rita Ora for a moment, because Cardi's on the song. And then Cardi took to Twitter and was like, I've had experiences with women and I didn't know it was weird. I didn't know it was bad to use the word dyke, et cetera, et cetera. And I was thinking a lot about her role on the show Love and Hip Hop. And she appears on the show frequently with her sister Hennessy, who is out as a lesbian. And during parts of the show and Cardi's career is first coming online, Cardi's in a relationship with somebody who's in prison. And she's like talking about loyalty and talking about being with him. And, you know, can she wait? And then she's also being like, because I'm like, I'm sexual. Like, I want to get it in. And then her sister's like, yeah, you're going to wait 2 years for that D or whatever. And she's like, in the meantime, I have vagina. And it's this weird moment because on some hand, it's like she's also almost saying that like women don't count and she can have. But on the other hand, she's kind of like, so openly, like, I get down with girls that it actually, and it sneaks in this way. And that show does deal with gayness in other ways. There's, like, Snoop from The Wire on the show very openly in a gay relationship. There are gay men that are on that show at some point. It isn't, it's part of this spectrum that feels, it doesn't feel inauthentic, which is really, really, really interesting. But I also think, when I think about Janelle Monáe and I think about what still feels a little off, even though I'm going to count that as an exciting, I'm going to chalk it up to exuberance, a signal of things moving forward. I count it as progress. I think it is monumental for 15, 16, 17 year olds who don't live in coastal cities to look at Janelle Monáe and be like, she feels queer. Mm-hmm. So it's okay for me to be queer too.
Yep.
I count that as a win, but I also think the reason it kind of feels off a little bit because there are women in the spotlight who are major musicians of color who are openly talking about and not wearing vagina pants, but talking about vagina and like embracing it and not treating it as Judy Chicago art piece.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's the difference for me.
Mm.
One thing you keep mentioning when talking about the works, the cultural works that resonated to you in your youth, is that they live on a very one particular end of the emotional spectrum, which is pain and trauma, loneliness, isolation. Mm. And a lot of the cultural products right now that are coming out about gayness and queerness are really celebratory, really exuberant. You know, that entire Janelle Monáe album could be like hashtag queer girl magic. Is that the difference that feels inauthentic to you?
Here's what I would say. Everything about Losing My Religion feels private, right? It feels intimate. It isn't so much that I'm longing for a kind of political torment or I'm nostalgic for a kind of loneliness and suffering. I just feel like the music that I responded to spoke to a sort of emotional loneliness that I felt. You know, like listening to Melissa Etheridge plead for love and the attention of another person who I just assumed was a woman. I just feel like there's a power in all this music.
You know what's funny, Wesley, and what you just shared is that we're kind of circling around the same point, except I'm a Scorpio, so I'm deeply interested in the gore and sex scenes and how real they feel. And you're a Sag, and so you're very interested in kind of the more emotional tenor of what you're seeing and experiencing.
But
this is kind of, we're coming back to the exact same point, though, which is that we want to feel, I mean, this is what we're always asking of culture on the show, right? Mm-hmm. We're always asking for something that feels human, not fake, not artificial. Yes. And that's sort of what we want from, I guess, our gay materials, medias, content, whatever the hell you call
it. The truth.
It. We want the truth.
Some truth from the person giving it to us. You know, it's true. Like, I listened to Michelle and Ndegeocello's Bitter, which is one of my favorite records. It is a beautiful album. I assume she's singing about relationships with women. And, you know, I hear longing, I hear pain, I hear joy.
So do you want the musicians of today who are dealing with intimacy and sensuality and sexuality in their work to go farther in the way that it felt the artist of your, I guess, quote, youth did? I mean, what do you want from these people? What do you want from them, Wesley? What do you want?
I want great art to come out of your sexuality. And
that's what you're making your art about.
That's what you're making your art about, right? And if I smell a rat, I'm going to call the exterminator.
You know, I think we're halfway there. I think that the work that we're seeing now does reflect the moment that we're in. I think we're fumbling towards a kind of horizon. I think there was a period of time where it was harder to be definitively declaratively out. Mm-hmm, so the work was about that longing to be known. And I think now, I think I know what I am, and I'm trying to figure out how to make the work reflect that in a way that isn't super alienating it. And maybe that's why it can feel a little lukewarm at times too. I think we're getting there. I think we're halfway between where you perceive things to have been and where we want things to go. Maybe in 10 years, the idea of a pansexual identity won't feel super vague because there will be movies about it, or there will be more accurate shows. Maybe the 10th season of She's Gotta Have It will actually feature somebody who does live life as a, what did she say, sex positive, polyamorous, pansexual, who is basically just bisexual. Like, we'll see that on screen. And that'll be
10
great.
10 more seasons of that, though?
Well, that's just, you know, I'm just trying to project us. I'm just putting us in the spaceship and getting us on the Hyperloop and throwing us into the future.
I'll get on and go. Is Lando going to be on the ship?
If you're lucky.
That's our show.
Still Processing is a product of the New York Times.
It's produced by Nina Patak.
Our editor is Sasha Weiss.
And we get editorial oversight from Lisa Tobin and Samantha Hennig.
Our engineer is Jake Gorski.
Our theme music is by Kindness. It's called World Restart from the album Otherness.
You can find all of our episodes and fun things at nytimes.com/stillprocessing.
And remember to leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, please.
Bye.